You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
There's something happening here.
This is a song of the 60s, right? They played this last night after the, I want to say, after they kind of dealt with the Democratic National Convention. Pretty incredible. Joining us from Florida, I think, but he's been traveling a bit, so I'm not sure, is Tom Droughty, retired Marine Corps Brigadier General with three tours in Vietnam, and have been anxious to have him on and get his thoughts. So, Tom, first of all, welcome back. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you. My pleasure, Mac. Always an honor to be part of anything that you're doing, and happy to help and share thoughts with you at any time. And yeah, I have been doing the traveling and back for a while, and ironically, as I mentioned, leaving this Thursday for a reunion of my rifle company, Mike 37, which this year will be out in Albuquerque. So I'll be with guys that I first met on a parade deck at Camp Pendleton in 1963 when they had just come from boot camp, and I was a brand new second lieutenant. So we go back a long way, and tours overseas, and still maintain a great relationship and camaraderie.
Let me ask you about some current events. General Kelly made a statement last night, who is now the chief of staff. I believe every American, when the national anthem is played, should cover their hearts and think about all the men and women who have been maimed and killed. Every American should stand up and think for three lousy minutes. I'm curious about your thoughts. Are the prism that we view the world as veterans is so different from the rest of the nation, especially now that, less of the nation serves? And I think a lot of us suffer in silence, the pain we feel in our heart when you see the flag that you fought for, the country that you love, with all its warts. But you know its warts are prettier than the warts of the rest of the world because you've been around the world and you've seen it and how lucky we are to be able to live in the United States. So with that mix of anxiety thrown into it, I'm curious about your thoughts.
Sure, Mac. First of all, I agree totally with General Kelly. You know, as a veteran, that's exactly how I feel. But I think the operative word is should. And oftentimes what we should do is not what we actually perform or behave. And I just, cutting right to the chase, do individuals have the right to take a knee, to sit down, et cetera, to show, I guess, their feelings towards their country and its national anthem and its flag? Yeah, that is the First Amendment right, and they certainly have the right to do so. What I guess intrigues me, though, is that I think there should be some connection between the action that you're demonstrating, which is authorized by the First Amendment, and the outcome that you wish to achieve. Let me give an example. I think you know well that I'm a Roman Catholic,
yes.
And so I'm totally against abortion. So what I have done is with other Catholics have stood outside of a place that provides abortions with signs that basically say, here's some help that you can get rather than carry out this procedure, you know, protect life and so forth. So I guess the point is I could have, during a national anthem, I guess, taken a knee to show my disrespect to the Supreme Court for allowing abortion to continue, but there'd be no connection there. The connection is to take action that demonstrates what it is that you hope will change, what you hope will be different, but not to mock the country that you're mocking, the country that provides you that opportunity to express your free will or your thoughts. So I guess that's my take with the whole business of the national anthem as a veteran, you know, absolutely, that's what you do as a demonstrate your respect for the flag and for the national anthem. And for those who don't, again, certainly they're right, but that doesn't mean it's something that I think they ought to do.
How about this? And let's just use the issue that started all of this, which was the issue of black men being shot by police officers at a disturbing rate. This is Mike McNamara talking, but I'm curious your thoughts about it. And then we'll talk about Vietnam, which is fascinating, by the way. If you take a knee, in my opinion, by making that statement, you have a moral obligation to use the unique forum that you have to act and be a leader on the issue that you've decided to make such a public display about. If you don't get after the NFL to reach out to the Fraternal Order of Police Officers and law enforcement agencies around the nation to use the power of the NFL as a marketing tool, to have dialogue, to come up with a series of steps, maybe possible things that need to be funded in order to remedy that problem, in my opinion, you are simply a clanging gong. You are a hollow cymbal, and you ought to be embarrassed for what you're doing. If you take those additional steps, I think there's better ways to make that statement. I respect it. If you don't take those additional respects, I don't respect you. In fact, I look at you with scorn as a coward. Your thoughts on that statement?
Well, I think what you've captured is what I was trying to say, but you've done it better, Mac, and that is to connect your actions with the outcome that you desire.
Right.
And exactly, to work with groups that will have better relationships between the police and the community, or something as elementary as encouraging people to vote, encouraging people to be part of the dialogue, that part of the education that will bring about improvement. So rather than to mock the country that allows you to mock it, take the action that will correct the injustice, the issue that you have, and in order to make it better. So I think you've captured perfectly what my take would be on, and that is do something about it, but do something that has some meaning rather than something that's going to offend so many people who, in the case of veterans, who put a lot on the line to ensure that you have the right to offend us.
We'll transition now. General thoughts on PBS series. Start with, as a Vietnam veteran, your thoughts even before it began to show. Were you going to watch it from the start? Did you have mixed feelings about it? Were you undecided? I've rebranded the term the greatest generation. There is no greater generation in the history of the United States than the generation that spawned Vietnam veterans. There is no group that has been through more from fighting to returning home and stayed the course and continue to make contributions and be leaders in our society than the Vietnam generation. So with no intention to slight anybody, when you look at the greatest generation that the nation's ever spawned, there has been no generation that more has been required of than the Vietnam veterans. And so I say that. There's much anxiety in that community, though, whether this would just be another hatchet job, another mistelling of the story, and maybe to be anticipated, but then to be disappointed again. And I've seen a bunch of those emails. I'm curious your thoughts before the program came on, given Ken Burns' reputation as a documentary maker.
Sure, Mac. First of all, I was really looking forward to it for a couple of reasons. The things that I've seen of Ken Burns, baseball, the Civil War, a quick war story. When I joined 1st Marine Division in 1990 as we were getting ready for Desert Storm. The Civil War had just completed, and I remember when I arrived and kind of bringing people up to date as what's happening back in the States, because I joined the division after they were in Saudi Arabia. I told them one of the first things that you should do when you get back, maybe not the first thing, but one of the first things you should do is to watch this series on the Civil War, because it was so well done. So I was inclined to think that if nothing else, Ken Burns was going to be thorough in his presentation. The question was, would there be an agenda? And I didn't see an agenda in the Civil War, and certainly no agenda in the baseball series, but nevertheless, as a Vietnam veteran and seeing some of the horrible things that have been done regarding the Vietnam War, there's always that question. The other is that, I was going to watch it because as a Vietnam veteran, I felt it was my duty to watch it, because I would be asked questions like yours, my children, friends, and so forth would say, what did you think of the series? And I know some Vietnam veterans have said, I don't want to watch it. You know, I've been there. I don't want to relive it and so forth.
Right.
Certainly their choice. But, you know, you have, again, one of those teaching opportunities when someone says, what did you think? And now you have that common reference of, well, here's what I thought of this, and here's my experience in that particular situation, et cetera. If you walk away from that and say, no, I'm not going to be a part of it, I'm not going to be educate myself in that regard, then I think you're cheating those who look to you for answers. You and I would not be having this conversation right now if I had said, I'm just going to eschew this Ken Burns thing because I think it's going to be a hatchet job. And what was even worse in some of the emails that I've read is people who had not even seen it who were condemning it. And, you know, my comment there is, I think that's called prejudice, where you prejudge something. For goodness sakes, if you're going to critique or comment, then watch the damn thing rather than take somebody else's, you know, view of it. So with all of that said, I was looking forward to the series, and we'll get into it, but I guess my bottom line in watching seven of them is I've been most impressed with the absence of any kind of an agenda. I've been impressed with the thoroughness. I've been impressed with the contrast of seeing the war not only from the U.S. side, but also from the Viet Cong side and from the NBA side and from the South Vietnamese side. And not somebody's interpretation of that, but the actual words of people who were there. Granted, you know, we all have our perceptions, and I certainly would have mine as well, but the words of people who were there, you know, like Carl Melantis and Caputo and others that, you know, were there, that has meaning for me, as well as the tremendous opportunity as a Vietnam veteran to see what was in the minds of the NVA and the Viet Cong. I mean, this is a true revelation that I think is certainly beneficial to me and for anybody who is a student of the Vietnam War. And I guess finally, the really touching aspects, I have to say that the tears are part of every episode with me, watching those things that happen, especially the effects on the troops who fought and their families at home. And we need to be reminded of that from time to time, the sacrifices that were made, not just by those of us who were in country, but also those home. And I guess my only critique of it is I don't think enough time and emphasis is paid on what was happening with the people back home, and certainly the protesters, that was part of history and that's got to be covered, but how about the families who sat in front of those TVs every night seeing the things that were taking place there and imagining that their loved one was right in the middle of all of that. You know, my family went through that, and, you know, we talk about it, but I'm not sure. That's the only thing that I don't think is covered in sufficient depth. But, again, I've seen only seven of the episodes. So, Mac, I'm sorry, a long-winded answer to your question, but that's my first take on it.
No, much welcomed. And it's brought up. I mean, it's been great for us here to watch because it brings up a lot of questions. First of all, the Marines are so young, Tom. I mean, and it's like in watching it, where are the NCOs? It's like I see 19-year-old Lance Corporals as squad leaders. And it's like, is that an anomaly? Is that because of the rotation thing? Can you talk to us about, I mean, it just seems like the Marines there are so young, which means they're novices in terms of military life and how you do this. And we're such a different force now. Can you explain to us in the units that you had that you went with? Were they that young? And was it a function of? Because Marlanis told me a story. He tells this funny story about after he'd been there, I think the better part of a month, that they're cleaning weapons. He said, I'd proved it. You know, I kind of knew what I was doing a little bit. And I think he said my guys had accepted me. And one of my 19-year-old Lance Corporal squad leaders came over and said, you know, is it true that you're a Rhodes Scholar and you went to Yale? And Marlanis says, yeah, that is true. And the kid then looks at him and says, you've got to be the dumbest fucking Rhodes Scholar on the planet. And with that, you know, everybody's sitting around cleaning weapons. They all laugh. And Marlanis laughs and says, you could probably make the case that that's a fact. But 19-year-old Lance Corporal. Now, I thought that was an anomaly. But I hear it more and more and more, Tom. So could you explain the rotational policy and how that affected, you know, Vietnam and who led and who was there?
Surely. Now, keep in mind that initially we went in as a unit.
Right.
I was part of 3-7. Actually, the first unit I went was part of 1-3 in my platoon in 64. But then in 65, went in as a unit. So we had, and that was the kind of the best of all worlds, Mac. This was a battalion that had trained together. I mean, we all knew one another. Half the battalion had spent an overseas tour in Okinawa, but, you know, training in the northern training area, Japan, you know, Taiwan, et cetera. So we had the NCOs. We had maturity that is hard to believe. You know, we had first sergeants who were World War II veterans. But most of our officers were created by those battalion commanders, XO and so forth, were World War II and or Korean veterans. So we had, with the officers, staff NCOs, you know, that experience, and on through the NCOs as well. But then as time went on and you start to take casualties, now come the replacements. And the replacements, of course, are filling the gaps. And so for the most part, the replacements would be on a as-needed basis of an NCO for an NCO. But then as time went by, Mac, somehow the personnel situation just didn't catch up to reality. And my battalion, after 13 months, those who survived were going home. And during that period of time, we were being filled in then by replacements. But just to give you an example, I was a company commander, and I had extended my tour. For over 30 days, I was the only officer in my company. I also had no first sergeant. I also had no admin chief. So, but we were running operations. I mean, everything had to continue on, and thank God I had a background in admin. But, you know, I did all the investigations. I was the pay officer. It was just, and I kept thinking, where are the officers? And so finally, a lieutenant showed up, and I said, thank God. So the infantry commander sat him down and said, okay, here's the situation. You don't have to do anything brave. Just don't do anything stupid. You know, the stuff that they taught you at the basic school, you're going to be okay. You know, watch the NCOs, you know, learn from them as well. And with one unit diary entry, I joined him, assigned him hostile fire pay, assigned him an MOS, and dropped him as wounded in action. In less than 24 hours, he had come and gone. That's how quickly at times the turnover was, and then I had to wait again for the next lieutenant to show up. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but we went in with I mean, the best we could possibly be with a well-trained, experienced organization. And then as time went by, with casualties, the end of rotation, et cetera, then the replacements were great Marines. I mean, I had draftees who were great Marines as well. So, you know, it wasn't a case of the quality. It's just that, as is pointed out, a lot of it is supply and demand. And if you had a good Marine that showed what is needed, then he was going to become an NCO. We all had to learn quickly at a young age, Mac.
So, Tom, so this makes sense to me, and I'll read you an email. So you go in as Philip Brown, and then this replacement system, ultimately you're replaced as the company commander as well, but you have this influx of onesies and twosies, individual Marines as replacements, as Mike Company stays there, and everybody just rotates through Mike Company. So you might have a corporal show up, you might have a couple of corporals, you might have a sergeant, but it's all built-in country, and it's all individual replacements, and that's how it goes after the initial unit deploys?
Yes, exactly. And, so that, and one of the things that comes with that is you have the challenge of experience, because now you've got experience kind of rotated throughout the unit with the old guys who have been there, but then with it to pass on to the new guys to hope that they can survive the early days, which increases their chance of survival, because so many times the early arrivals, and it is just one of those things of, you know, there's training and education. Training is preparation for certainty. Education is preparation for uncertainty. And you and I know that combat is a lot of uncertainty. And if you can prepare that new guy, the replacement, but the other part of that was for those who have been there to embrace that new guy and understand what he was going through. I mean, it's all new. It's all kind of scary. It's all the rest of it. And so, you know, there's a great movie because of how horrible it is, and that's the movie Platoon. And I'm sure most people have seen it, but
right. But
so many people, well, that was what Vietnam is about. Well, that wasn't, but one of the things in Platoon is, remember that the new guy, they made fun of him.
Right.
You know, they've been walking. You would never do that. The new guy has got to be part of the unit. The new guy has got to be part of the team, and you don't do that by ridiculing him. You get him, you know, broken in and show him the ways. And, you know, that band of brothers that we talk about was especially critical for the replacements coming in so that they could, you know, not only contribute but also survive.
In your experience, which way did most units come down on? By not wanting to get close to that guy? Because that's what you hear from guys in World War II. You know, they got killed too fast. You didn't want to get to know them. You know, once they stuck around for a while, then you would. But when they first got there, your initial instinct was they got kept at arm's length. You stayed with the guys that you had come there with, were friends with. And it took them a while, you know, to be around long enough to crack that social circle. Your experience, what did you see more of, or was it a mix?
I can only comment on what happened in my company, Mike 37, but our view, my view was, you know, these are Marines, this is what's going to keep us going, and so this nonsense of don't make friends with them or don't get to know them because they become casualties is absolutely nonsense. I mean, this is a team. You fight for one another because of that comradeship. You know, you fight for your buddy. A quick C story. One of our reunions, I think it's the first reunion that we had, a Marine walked up to George Martin and said, "Sir, do you remember when I reported into to my company?" And I said, "I really don't, George, but why do you remember?" He said, "Well, sir, don't you remember? You know, I walked in and I came up and you're talking to me, and all of a sudden, you know, all hell breaks loose and they're screaming and hollering and explosions and noise and so forth. And you said, Martin, go jump in that hole over there. I'm going to be kind of busy and we'll talk later." And I said, no, George, I don't remember that. Why do you? What is the big deal? And George is really hurt. And he said, sir, the big deal was you knew my name. You knew my name. If I had gotten blown away that day, somebody would have known that George Martin went out as a fighting Marine because you knew my name. So, for those who said, well, I'm not going to, adopt, associate, embrace, the replacements, but what a horrible thing to do, and I just have to question the leadership of anybody who would tolerate something like that.
Well, you know what, it's one of the things, that lessons that I've learned about Vietnam, through studying My Lai and leadership in Vietnam, depending on what year you were there and where you were there and how different the war was, that leadership is leadership. The challenges are the same. Vietnam certainly had its own uniqueness, but leadership is leadership. So it's interesting. Let me read you an email. Tim Lynch forwarded this to me. He is the son of Jarvis Lynch, who you know. And,
I know him. I know there's two sons. One was a Navy corpsman and then became a Marine.
So I know both of his sons. So Tim forwarded me this. So Tim's uncle, he called him Chad, but I interviewed him as Chuck. One of the things Chuck said that was he left Vietnam, came home, became a recruiter in upstate New York, and did over 100 CAECO calls in 1968, I think it was.
Wow.
Exactly. You're like, I've heard a lot of impressive things in combat, but I haven't heard of a lot more impressive things in peacetime than that. And in any time than that, because that'll give you a drinking problem in no time. Anyway, Tim grew up with Vietnam, right? All his dad's friends were Vietnam veterans, and so he's watched it with great interest. And here's the email quote: I was on Hill 55. This is a Con Tien Marine. I was on Hill 55 with 1-1 long after this in 1969 and most of 1970. 1-1 deployed to Hill 37 a few miles away to the southwest. I never knew this story. We had always heard of 1-9 as the Walking Dead, but never heard the real story. Con Tien was known as a meat grinder. My shop sergeant, I was a comtech, was there and was back on his second tour. Always wondered about the rotation policy. It never made sense. We were proud, but as you say, there wasn't much unit cohesion. Everyone from day one was counting the days until rotation, quote, back to the world, unquote. Aside from the squad you served with, I doubt if many even remember who was in charge or who else they served with. And that's from a sergeant by the name of Jesse Brow. So it's just interesting. You know, you see how young the Marines are in this video, in this documentary, and it's amazing that these young guys, out there as novices, really, and what they did in Vietnam and the contribution that they made. And to be honest with you, given the lack of unit cohesion, it's amazing that more bad stuff didn't happen, because that is kind of an environment that you would expect, that, you know, it's going to be fraught with the dangers that come with novices as they go through experiences that are not meant for novices. So it's an interesting part of the documentary.
Yeah, it really is. And you've hit, I think, on a key point. Another one that I'll just share with you that added to some of the strange things that took place in Vietnam was the command policy. The command policy of being in command, like a battalion, company, and so forth, for just 6 months. And this is in the Army as well as in the Marine Corps. And the idea was that everyone in the command position should have an equal opportunity to someday become chief of staff of the Army or commandant of the Marine Corps. And so, 6 months, you're just barely starting to, for many cases, really becoming as effective as it should be, hopefully before then. But added to this, and I wrote a paper on this when I was at Leavenworth as a student, not a prisoner, on the relief of battalion commanders and below during Vietnam. And, I mean, it was horrendous, Mac. I had classmates, Army majors, when they're in Vietnam, in a one-year tour, would have five battalion commanders with the combination of the 6 months and then the reliefs that were taking place. So, you know, where's the continuity? And where was the idea that maybe we ought to be fighting to win rather than fighting to not lose?
Where did that come from, Tom? Do you have any idea, where, any sense of where that came from? Was that a Vietnam thing? Did it come out of, I mean, was that a World War II thing? Did it come out of Korea? Where did that notion of this kind of egalitarian, everybody rates, you know, an opportunity to command? Because, again, now it sounds so crazy. Any idea where it came from?
I don't. It was, but a Vietnam thing, that was not the case in World War II or Korea for certain.
Right. So it's odd. Let me just switch gears for you. I want to get to the NVA and the Viet Cong perspective, which I think is absolutely fascinating in all of this. But before I do that, I have a second Lieutenant McNamara question. I joined the Marine Corps in 1983, got to the 1st Marine Division in 1984. Nobody taught me about Con Tien. Nobody taught me about Khe Sanh. If you ask me, and yet everybody, I can remember, I was telling the story of being, before you got to be the CO of 5th Marines, as I was leaving, General Brantner, at the time Colonel Brantner, and, you know, we all knew that he had won two Navy Crosses on Vietnam, in Vietnam. We used to see him with most of his, one of his calves blown out. We would see him running in his red PT shorts every day at noon around Margarita. And, you know, we'd see his, you know, his leg. We'd see him out there hobbling. And, like, oh, that's Colonel Brantner. But we never heard the stories. Was there a reluctance post-Vietnam to talk about it? Because, you know, Vietnam, out of Vietnam comes the best boot, in my opinion, that's ever been designed. And that is the jungle boot. Yet we weren't allowed to wear it. The bush cover comes out of Vietnam. We weren't allowed to wear that either. And woe be to you if you got caught wearing it. And so why didn't more of that stuff get shared?
You know, it's a great point. Again, when I began my course at Leavenworth, it was in 1975. And of course, in April, this was in, I guess, July of 75. In April of 75 was when the final pull-up, final fall of Saigon, as we know.
Right.
At the Army Command and General Staff College, you know, preparation for command and serving on a general staff, as the name would imply, no one from the podium, from the stage, no one spoke of Vietnam. It is almost like if we don't talk about it, it didn't happen. The complete emphasis was on the fold the gap. It was going to be on the next war, and we're going to put deep in our memories Vietnam. And I remember one of the presentations I gave was on Vietnam, and it was, I think it was about Tet. And it was like, holy mackerel, it's almost like I had committed a sin by mentioning Vietnam here at this professional school. So why was that? Well, I think part of it was, you know, it never happened. You know, we didn't lose, or if it didn't turn out the way we wanted, if we don't mention it, then it won't be, you know, so painful. And I used to revel in the number of individuals who would, particularly in the Army, who would say, you know, we didn't lose in Vietnam. We won every battle and so forth, and not lost it. And I would just listen to them, you know, very patiently, and then say, you know, if we didn't lose in Vietnam, then that exodus off the roof of the American Embassy was the strangest victory parade I've ever seen. And the problem, Mac, was if you don't accept that you lost, then you don't start analyzing what went wrong. If you think that it all turned out well, as some people in their idiocy do, then what is there to analyze? I mean, what could you possibly change if it was a success? And the Marine Corps, to its credit, embraced the thought of what went wrong, what can we do better, how are we going to make this. The Army, at least from my experience in those years, had not adopted that. It was, okay, well, that was counterinsurgency, and we'll never do that again. And now we're going to focus on the fold the gap and beat the Soviet Union. There's a whole challenge of military thinking and, I guess, human nature that comes into play here. But, you know, as a military, we have to be ready for a number of things. But one of the things we certainly don't want to do is to forget what we learned. To let those, it's bad enough to go through the tragedies, but it's even worse to not learn from them and say, okay, what are we going to do better now in order to ensure that doesn't happen again? Not sure I answered your question.
No, you didn't. Why didn't they teach? So you say they accepted it, but I never got taught it. I never learned about My Lai. I'd have been fascinated to hear from you guys that were there, because you guys used to walk around with all these bronze stars and purple hearts and all this shit, right? All these ribbons that I didn't really understand, the green and white one, the yellow and red one, but I knew they were Vietnam, right? You know, and yet, but I didn't. You say you accepted it, but I didn't go to a series of PMEs on Vietnam. What it was like, the first guy I heard talk about a lot was Zinni and his officer school that he did when he was CO of the 9th Marines. That he talked about how the Vietnamese built a position. You know, that it wasn't linear, that it was more like an X, that when you went to envelop it, you still got caught in this crossfire. Right, you went to turn it, you still got hit in this crossfire. So we didn't understand it. It wasn't an L, it wasn't a line. It was more of an X, and we didn't do X's. We did other things. And so I thought that was fascinating, fascinating stuff. And I don't know. It just it's one of those things that as I watched this, I don't want to say in a way I feel like I got cheated. I feel like I wanted to hear what you guys went through, but it's like we didn't wear the uniform, and then you'd see guys bust out. When I got to the basic school, I think the guy's name was Lovingwell. He was I think he was lieutenant colonel. He might have been, I'll remember his name, something like that. But he used to wear his Vietnam jungle utilities, and they were a lighter gray. They had slanted pockets, like things that we would go back to. They were made of a lighter material, that ripstop material they were made of. And you looked at them and you're like, why am I wearing leather boots in this swamp-ass hot Quantico in the summer? His uniform looks so much better in terms of comfort and functionality. Yet we're not allowed to do this. We've broken contact with that part of our history. And I when I watch now, I see how rich this is, not only in counterinsurgency, but also in conventional operations. I mean, I didn't know shit about Conti yet. And I'm watching this going, holy shit, man. Park them under the artillery fan of the NVA and wish them good luck and say, we're going to do movement to contact up there, boys. Let's go. Make sure you have your chin straps on. Holy shit, man. Pretty amazing. And I in a way I felt like I got cheated. Like, hey, you guys cheated me, man. You didn't tell me about your shit. And I just wondered if it was the stigma of Vietnam that kept a lot of that, you know, us from not being taught that.
Yeah, it's a great point. And as strange as you were talking, I thought, you know, this is the same criticism that I had of the World War II and Korean vets who didn't share particularly the aspects of combat leadership and the talk that I used to give on fatigue, fear, failure, and feelings regarding combat leadership. But as you were talking, I realized I made that same mistake. I should have, as a commander, done those things, have shared those experiences, and I guess there's kind of the feeling of, well, if, will this look like self-aggrandizement on my part? And it would not have been, and I wish now that I'd done that, Mac. It's a valid criticism.
Well, you know what? It's interesting because, you know, one of the things Zinni says, he said, you know, I hesitate to talk about my experiences because, you know, maybe it didn't happen the way I thought it did. Maybe things that I thought were sequential really were more random than sequential. And I thought there was a cause and effect relationship between this and this, and now in hindsight, maybe there wasn't. So I'm reluctant. But at the same time, when you're building a base from an empty, you know, dry erase board, you need that, whether it's prejudiced or not, you need to hear it, I think. And I just wrote myself a note, the things that I would put in my book that's going to be entitled Things I'd Like My Sons to Know Before They Go to War is talk about your combat experiences. Don't be like everybody and say, I don't want to pump my own tire. Don't pump your own tire, but talk about the things that you experience and things that they're going to encounter so they can think about it, so you can put it in their heads. Because I would say institutionally, there is a bias not to talk about it because you don't want to pump your own tire. You don't want to make yourself something that you weren't. And you might be reluctant to say, yeah, this is the big lesson of it. But if you don't do that, then you leave a void there. Void needs to be filled. So to me, it's very interesting, though, Tom, these kind of things that are coming out of watching this. One of the most riveting pieces, though, and I'm curious your reaction to it, is listening to the NVA perspective and the Viet Cong perspective of this. You have experiences against both. What has it been like for you to listen to it? And to me, it's pretty odd because we've been in a digital age for a while. Yet this is the first time that I have seen interviews like this done with, you know, soldiers from the Army of North Vietnam and with guys who fought with the Viet Cong. And it's like, wow, why did it take for this to happen for us to hear that perspective, oddly enough? But I think it's been riveting. Your thoughts as a guy who fought these guys?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up on the experiences. Sure. Adding to all of that is, as we discussed, and I couldn't agree with you more, also include the things that you wish you had done differently.
Right.
Or that you made, or, you know, those things that indicate that you've learned and that you're willing to pass on not only the good, but those things that you wish had maybe come out in a different way. So it's all part of being brutally honest with the things that we've done. It's what, the way that brains, at least from my experience, do after action or the hot wash-up, and that is to really lay it out there, because to withhold the truth risks the life and limb of a Marine in the future.
Right.
If you don't share the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Well, that to me is the key thing. You know, at least look, the conversation doesn't have to be smooth and clean and all tied together. What you need to present is this concept of the flawed leader who struggles to overcome his flaws, because we're all in that boat together.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And I think if you start from that period, look, let me put these out there. I wasn't perfect. I tried as hard as I could. I tried to be good. I did as much bad and made as many mistakes as I made good. I told a story last week about having lunch at Wendy's up Mainside at Camp Pendleton, and my buddy Pete Flood from Schenectady, New York. I'm a second lieutenant. He's a first lieutenant. And we're standing in line, and he says, Mac, that's Jay Vargas. I said, who's Jay Vargas? And I think Pete had memorized every Medal of Honor winner and every Navy Cross winner in Vietnam. He said he won the Medal of Honor in Vietnam. So Lieutenant Colonel Vargas at the time, he got his lunch and he sat down. And being a lieutenant colonel, nobody sat near him. So Pete Flood and I, Pete looks at me and goes, come on, let's go talk to him. I said, no, come on, we're not going to bug him. He goes, I want to talk to him. So we go sit down. And we walk up to him and say, sir, do you mind if we join you for lunch? And he looks up and he says, I'm not talking about it. And I looked at Flood and I said, I told you. I said, I'm sorry, sir. And he says, no, sit down. And so we're talking to him, and he says, look, let me bottom line this thing. It was my mistake. I put him there. I wasn't doing anything except trying to unscrew what I had screwed up. So this notion of me doing something heroic is completely ridiculous. I wasn't. I was unscrewing a mistake, and other people were paying for it. What else was I going to do? And it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. I didn't expect. That's not what I expected. There wasn't one trumpet playing in that whole statement he made. And it was a very sobering look at leadership that these guys, most of the time, they're not doing anything other than what they think they're supposed to do, what anybody else would do, and they articulate that later. I didn't do anything special. I just did my job, what I thought I should do. So it's really interesting.
And you couldn't have a more perfect example of humility and poise under fire than Jay Vargas, a true hero in many respects. And we attended National War College together, served together. Just a great guy. So I can picture that. That scene without any stretch of imagination.
I was embarrassed. Talk to me about watching, I would think for the first time in this kind of complete fashion, the guys you fought about talking about what it was like to fight against you. I found it riveting, the NVA concept of you got to get in tight, you've got to hold him by the belt. And even, it was that, Marine by the name of Musgrave talking about fighting outside of Compiègne, and they used to call them brawls, and he talked about being wounded. He said, and the machine gun was, he said, 9 feet away from me. Not a nine, Tim Lynch and I were talking, and Lynch said, I don't know if he said 9 feet or 9 meters. And then I watched it again, and he says 9 feet, and another Marine comes to get him. It must be fascinating for you to see, to hear that perspective, both from NVA and VC.
Yeah, it really is. Just a quick, and then talking with General Chuck Krulak, 31st Commandant, the same thing has come across to him, and that is now we get to hear what the NVA and Viet Cong were thinking. And so this is, you know, one of those things to which I am grateful to Ken Burns. Interesting, that phrase, I did a review for Naval Institute Proceedings on a book called Grab Them by Their Belts, and it was written by an NVA, and it was about that very thing. And that is one of the things that the Viet Cong and NVA did was learned and then put into practice the things that they learned in fighting us. I think that's somewhat demonstrated in the Yadrang Valley, the fight with Hal Moore and the first of the 7th Cap. Horrible casualties suffered by the NVA, which they were willing to accept because in the process they learned this new concept of ours called the air assault. And so with it, because it's interesting that a follow-on to that is not often publicized, is the other, the 2nd of the 7th, walked into an ambush to the northeast of the Yadrang and really suffered horrendous casualties. I mean, that was a disaster compared to what 1-7 did. So getting back to what they learned. They learned very quickly that one of the things that we're good at besides shooting and so forth was the use of supporting arms. And their being without those, the only way that they could survive was to hit quick and to get in close enough to us that we would be reluctant or in some cases would not use supporting arms in order to fend them off. But from the standpoint of professional soldiers and fighting ability and so forth, the NVA and Viet Cong, the main force Viet Cong, were absolutely fantastic. I had nothing but the highest respect for them. Which I guess sounds strange. Can you respect your enemy? You're damn right you can. I sure do, because if you disrespect your enemy, then I think you're really setting yourself up, you know, for a disaster. But, it was one night when we got hit by a main force a battalion. The next day we're going through the bodies of those who had attempted to attack us or attempted to defeat us. And our sergeant major, I remember, was going through and finding little notebooks on their bodies that would have things like English phrases that they would use after they captured us, like, be quiet, hands up, you know, follow me. So translation of Vietnamese into English. And then lesson plans, if you can imagine this, on soldiering to include lessons on venereal disease. And you think, wait a minute, these are hardcore Viet Cong, but that's the kind of professionalism that we were facing. So to see them and to hear them and to get their valuation, you know, the point of Americans would take care of another American, and oftentimes that would work to our disadvantage in their mind, because you shoot the guy who's going out to pick up the guy who's been shot, and so that would continue. I thought it was interesting the one about cigarettes, and in so many of these scenes, you know, lots of guys smoked. I didn't on my first two tours, but I did the last, but nonetheless, you know, the smell that tobacco provides, but also the trail that was littered. You know, just interesting observations from the perspective of our enemy that I am really finding enlightening.
A couple of emails for you. Mac, I'm curious, from General Droughty, is there anything that he's seen that has disturbed him as either not true or something that was blown up to be something that he didn't think it was? So one of the things that it's interesting, talking to different people, the word balance keeps coming up, but it's caveated. For instance, I would tell you, Tom, that I think that that McNamara gets off light. No relation, by the way. I think he gets off easy in this thing. If you've read McMaster's book, you certainly look at him in a different light. Your thoughts, anything that you've seen that you think, geez, I think they maybe got that wrong? Or because I think just the scope of the project, Vietnam, everything that entails from the American perspective, civilian, military, right, and then rotate that times around to North Vietnamese and Viet Cong and continue to go around that wheel, that's a lot on every one of those subjects. But my own sense is that McNamara got off light. I'm wondering, have you had anything that you've seen that you said, you know what, I don't think he got that right?
I guess a couple of things. One is what has disturbed me the most is not a distortion or a deficit, at least thus far, and again, I have some more episodes to watch, but the degree of lying that was taking place at the senior levels, right, and from the president, and you talk about McNamara, and I'll talk about that in just a second, but, you know, I knew that in reading McMaster's book, Dereliction of Duty, and others, Mark Moyer's great book called Triumph Forsaken, there's some really fine books about that, but I didn't realize the degree. And to hear on tape the conversations that were the exact opposite of what the pronouncements were, and the realization that we were fighting a war to not lose rather than a war to win. I think of the sacrifices that were made by my troops and other troops, and that is highly disturbing. Why not more on McNamara? That may come to pass, I'm not sure, but the other thing that comes to mind is that McNamara, for whatever his intention was, and I have to assume that they were good intentions, I think tried to, for lack of a better term, apologize in two of his books. One is called In Retrospect, written in 95, and the other was Argument Without End in 99. He also was featured in a great documentary, I think it won an Academy Award, called The Fog of War, where he mentions the 11 lessons that he learned. So has McNamara gotten off light so far? In comparison to the presidents, Kennedy, Johnson, and now into Nixon, yeah. But again, the ultimate responsibility was with the president, and certainly the Secretary of Defense bears that responsibility as well. I can only kind of guess that maybe McNamara bought himself some forgiveness by his later actions in the form of the books that he wrote and his participation in an attempt to explain the mistakes that had been made.
Interesting. Carl Marlantis, and I think one of a very pointed things, little piece, and it can't be more than 60 seconds, talks about, I can forgive honest policy mistakes. And I'm paraphrasing here. He said, but what I can't forgive is men who knew that what they were doing was wrong. They were doing was wrong and did it anyway. And with that, you see is him stop speaking, but you see his mouth still quiver. And so 50 years later, that stuff's still so fresh. And I don't know that you can, I got an email that asked this, so I'll preface this. I think it's okay that McNamara wrote those books. I don't know that you ever get to come back from that, though. I think you should be banished because you failed a nation. Here's the email that.
Well, back, let me just add a phrase I heard one time. It's neither Christian nor American to hound to death a penitent sinner.
Yeah, but if you're not an innocent sinner, you know. A penitent sinner. Okay, you got me on that. I'm a bad American and a bad Catholic. But let me read you this email.
Good.
Mac, do you find it eerie the similarities between McNamara, Rumsfeld, and what went on in Vietnam, and what happened in Iraq, and what happened in Afghanistan? It seems to me we lost the bubble on the lessons of Vietnam. I'm curious about your thoughts and about General Droughty's thoughts. Tom, do you watch that with an eye to the present, or do you just watch it as a Vietnam event?
Oh, no. Always, or at least attempt to not view it in isolation, but what, if anything, did we learn from this? And then it's disturbing to see things that are reminiscent of those days. And whenever I start to, and it went on for a while and then kind of diminished, but when we started getting into metrics for success in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that horrible metric of body count started coming up again. And with it, reminiscence of an attrition war, and somehow that was going to be winnable for us in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, those things. I guess the realization that if you're fighting an insurgency, that the key is the people, as opposed to focusing on the enemy. You want to provide the security, of course, for the people, but. You know, there's a tendency in the military, Mac, and I was part of it as well, to do the things that we do well. At the end of Desert Storm, I remember turning to General Myatt and saying, you know, in retrospect, this is going to be considered in many ways a horrible thing for the military. And he said, Tom, how can you possibly say something like that? And I said, because this is going to be used as the example, this is how you do it. I mean, in 4 days it was all wrapped up and success and, you know, victory praise and so forth. This will never happen again.
Right.
This is an aberration, and yet for many this will be used as, well, this is what we train for in the future. This it's not going to be like this. And so, again, to view these things from the standpoint of what have we learned and how can we apply it today, I think it's a constant challenge, and that it requires a degree of introspection, but also a degree of absolute honesty of, you know, where were we wrong and what led us to come to those conclusions. And, you know, we don't start off saying, I'm going to choose to be an idiot. I'm going to choose to, to make the wrong decision, but what were the things we based too much on? What were the assumptions that we made that proved to be invalid? Those things that I think we can analyze and that we must analyze, otherwise it's all for naught. We just keep, you know, paying the price again and again, and the price is in, you know, the life and limb of our, you know, fantastic young men and women who were willing to step up and be part of this sacrifice.
Tom Droughty, my guest, Brigadier General, United States Marine Corps, and he's been gracious enough with his time this morning talking about the PBS documentary. Tom, interesting, because after Desert Storm, you know, one of the things that you heard was like, this is how it should be. This is the I'll use the word coronation, even though it's inappropriate. This is the coronation of the lessons learned from Vietnam, and this is the validation of what guys who fought in Vietnam have striven for. Is that right? Am I using that right? They have strived for over the course of all these years to have a clearly defined goal, have it be achievable, to be manned and equipped to do it, and given the task, and then the president back out of the way, let the military do it. That was one of the narratives that came out after Desert Storm. My own opinion is that the word you use is exactly right. It was an anomaly. It doesn't happen like that. That a guy lays down exactly how we practice it out in 29 Palms and tees it up for us. And then it's limited with somebody else paying for it and our ability to just get back on the boat and go home with a relatively small force left behind. Too clean doesn't work like that in the real world.
Yeah. And so we learned. And in that respect, we did take some of the lessons from Vietnam. And that was, again, at the national level, a clear cut, what is the goal? What do we intend to do? And when it's over, you know, then we stop and we come home. We don't get into mission creep of going into Baghdad, you know, out of Kuwait. I mean, those things that I think we did learn, unfortunately so. But, you know, it's a constant learning process. And, again, that preparation for the unexpected, the true definition, in my view, of education, preparation fronts certainty. And so the more we can educate our force, and part of that education is history. And it's got to be brutally honest history of what went right, but even more important at times, what went wrong, and how do we not make that mistake again?
Here's another question for you, Tom, or just kind of an email. Mac, did you know that Colonel Vargas was wounded 5 times in Vietnam? I did not. Tom, did you know that?
I forget how many gold stars he had on his Purple Heart, but as I recall, it was either 3 or 4. So if it was 4, then he was wounded 5 times. I would not.
He has 1 silver star on his Purple Heart, looking at his Wikipedia page. That's 5, yes or no?
Well, if he has a silver star, that is in lieu of 5 gold stars, so that would be a total of 6.
Holy shit. So somebody needs to teach Jay to duck. The level of combat, you know, and again, it's so interesting because they're in different years it's really interesting to talk to people because their experience is defined by where they were, what year they were there, and the war looks very different. Here's another email for you. Kind of emblematic of that. Matt, could General Droughty go over where he was, what years he was there? I have gained greater clarity watching the program and just am curious. I'm also interested, 1968, 3 different occasions that NVA soldiers and the Viet Cong were told to go on the offensive. Every one of them, they got their asses handed to them, but certainly strategically, it seems to be the right decision. Even if it was predicated on 2 invalid assumptions, that 1, the South Vietnamese army would fall apart, and 2, the people would rise up. Does General Dowdy have thoughts on why that kept happening? So two-part question. What years and where? And then your thoughts on 1968 and the consistent offensive operations of the NVA and the Viet Cong.
Yeah. In 1964, I took my platoon into Da Nang, providing security for the Marine helicopters that were there and also for the Da Nang airfield, of all things. Think of that with just a platoon. And also had enough to send Marines out to Special Forces Camp. But then later in 64, we were part of the response after the Gulf of Tonkin incident floating off the coast of Vietnam. Came back and then went back to Vietnam in 65, extended my tour into 66. 65, we went initially into Quy Nhon in preparation for the Army coming in later. We were part of Operation Starlight up in the Vung Tong area, not too far from Da Nang, and then ended up in the Chulai area, operating out of that area. And then I went back in 69 and 70, was with the Vietnamese Marines down in the Delta, as well as in Three Corps, and then was part of the Marines that went into Cambodia in 1970. So as a result, I ended up in serving in all four Corps areas, and in different parts of the war, and could see it from those different perspectives. So I'm truly blessed in having that that experience that I did, and then of course survive it, and therefore the interest that I have in Vietnam, in addition to it being such a major part of my life, and still is. The decision on the part of the NVA is interesting, especially in 1968 of how a horrible mistake can have such consequences, unexpected. Of course, the video, I think, points out very well the expectation was that with that attack in 1968, the Tet Offensive, that the people of South Vietnam would uprise, would there be just a turmoil on their part and would overthrow the South Vietnamese government, the province chiefs, the district chiefs, the national government, and so forth. Of course, that didn't happen, and after 68, the Viet Cong were in essence, eliminated as a fighting force. I mean, they got truly waxed. So from a tactical standpoint, it was a huge defeat. From a strategic standpoint, though, as we know, the effect was on the world, and especially in the United States, where there's already this kind of questioning of, you know, how long are we going to be in this, and are we really winning? To see pictures of Viet Cong inside the American embassy, inside the walls here, are in a place like Hue, where it took so long to get them up. With that came the psychological victory of, you know, we cannot win this, and now the demonstrations against the war became greater, leading things part and parcel, leading to the negotiations, the deals that were struck, and so forth. So I think it was a decision that, in retrospect, had a beneficial effect, but I don't think it had the tactical consequences that were desired, and that is the uprising of the country. That that didn't happen, but the end result of taking over the country was certainly reinforced by that strategic victory of Tet of 68.
Another question for you, Tom. Mac, I'm curious. Is there something that Tom hasn't seen that he'd like to see in the documentary so far? I would echo the thought that it appears to be very balanced. I spoke with a protester, and this is the second time I've heard this, a protester of sorts during Vietnam, and he's a little miffed because he doesn't think they are getting their due. And I would imagine, as I heard you say the other day, that Burns, if he does it well, will make everybody a little bit irritated that they didn't get their just due, skewing towards balance in all of what he represents. So is there anything that you haven't seen that you think he's missing? Because, again, the editorial decisions in terms of how you put something like this together, I think must have been the most fascinating part of it. How do we craft Vietnam so that we present it in a balanced way, and that's fair to the different viewpoints of such a emotional, such a violent, and such a life-changing event as Vietnam is. It's incredible. So anything that you haven't seen in it, Tom, that you think that they may have missed?
Yeah, I think when you and I were talking offline beforehand, what I haven't seen is that, and I think it's a critical point, is American families who had skin in the game. Now, we certainly have seen the American families whose loved one paid the ultimate price, and I thought that was done extremely well, and those are heart-rendering episodes and images of, again, the family that gets the news that their loved one has been killed. But for those other families that had someone there, regardless of whether they want to be there willingly or unwillingly, but the effect that had to exist for Americans sitting in front of their TVs, and of course this was the first real television war, and to see those images and to imagine in their minds their loved one in the middle of that, and of course that's not the case, but you know how human nature works. But and then the support, I used to get letters from, imagine this, Catholic school children, because the nuns have said, you got to write to this guy, and I treasure those, and I kept them. These kids have said, all the kids write so well. Have you killed anybody? But these, that aspect of the home front, that for those who were against the war and those who were for the war, but the American people, that's the one thing I have not seen that I think needs attention. What was happening back in the United States, not at the national level, not the politicians, not Congress, not the military, but how about, my hometown of Kankakee, Illinois? What were the people thinking about there? And for those for or against the war, it makes no difference, but that's part of history as well, and maybe it's not as dramatic and not as sexy as the other thing, and I'm not denigrating the other things, but I also understand that you can only do so much, and you're never going to please everyone. But your question of what have I not seen, that's something that I would have liked to have seen.
Tom Droughty, my guest here for a few more minutes. Tom, in terms of that part of the narrative, last night there was, I can't remember his name, but he went to Vietnam. He's written about it, and you saw him get very emotional. And he said, the thing that bothers me most wasn't getting shot at or anything. It's that I did not have the courage not to go. And it talked about that. And I talked about this the other day with a friend of mine who came on, who was categorized as 1Y in the draft. But his dad flew C-47s in Normandy, over Normandy and in World War II. It was part of Normandy, was part of Market Garden. All of his teachers and most of his coaches were veterans.
Yeah.
The post-World War II was drunk with veterans. They were everywhere. Korea, Vietnam. And if you fought in World War I and were between the ages of 20 and 25 when you fought, by 19, so by, let's see, 45 years later, you were 65 years old. And so you're still a relatively young man, when Vietnam's going on. And so you're a grandpa, your dad, is a World War II veteran, your older brother, a Korea veteran, and grandpa fought in World War I. And so when Vietnam comes, for this generation, it's their opportunity to join that fraternity. Talk about that. I mean, there was certainly much had been made in the second part, I think, of the documentary about the inequity in terms of who went and who stayed home.
Yeah. Two things. Tim O'Brien, as I think the guy you mentioned,
that's
he wrote a book
The Things They Carry. Very good book. But let me read from the best book I have ever read on Vietnam.
What is it?
The title is Enduring Vietnam, written by James Wright, a Marine, but did not serve in Vietnam. But my next course that I teach on Vietnam is I need only this book. But let me just read a couple of things from it. It says, this is Caputo coming ashore in 1965 at Da Nang. For Americans who did not come of age in the early 60s, it may be hard to grasp what those years were like. The pride, the overpowering self-assurance that prevailed. Most of the 3,500 men in our brigade, born during or immediately after World War II, were shaped by that era, the age of Kennedy's Camelot. We went overseas full of illusions, for which the intoxicating atmosphere of those years was as much to blame as our youth. War is always attractive to young men who knew nothing about it. But we had also been seduced in a uniform by Kennedy's challenge to ask what you can do for your country, and by the missionary idealism he had awakened in us. America seemed omnipotent then. The country could still claim it had never lost a war, and would believe we were ordained to play cop to the communist robber and spread our own political faith around the world. So when we marched into the rice paddies on that damp March afternoon, we carried, along with our packs and rifles, the implicit convictions that the Viet Cong would be quickly beaten and that we were doing something altogether noble and good. Powerful words, huh?
Well, and it does, you know, it does, I think, articulate well the environment that young men of that era grew up in. And even those who, you know, who opposed the war, they came from that same culture. And, can I ask you a question about guys who didn't fight? Do you have your own thoughts about the difference between guys who applied for conscientious objector status and guys who went to Canada?
Yeah, I do. I'm much more objective now than I was when I wore the cloth, and particularly when I was, serving in Vietnam. But I hold in higher regard conscientious objectors, because they're saying that conscience could not allow them to take up arms, but they could still serve in other ways, medics, corpsmen, and so forth. I just have a tough time with an individual who would say, I don't want to serve, I can't serve, and therefore I'm going to leave my country. I have a higher regard for those who said, I can't serve, I won't serve, I won't even serve as a conscientious objector, and have paid the price by going to prison. I mean, those are individuals of conscience, moral convictions. That's something to be admired, even if I disagree with them. But for those who said, my country has made this call on me, and I'm a citizen of this country, and I'm not going to respond. And so to avoid my obligations as an American citizen, an American male, I'm going to leave the country. Mac, I still have a tough time with that one. In case they don't need my forgiveness, I forgive them anyway, but I still have a tough time.
Interesting. And they covered part of that, I mean, was a family. I want to say it's a Harrison family, but the oldest son, the father was in the Army. The oldest son had gone to West Point and followed in his father's footsteps. The younger brother, they didn't feel was well suited. In fact, it's interesting to hear his sister talk. He joined the Marine Corps Reserve and then went AWOL a couple times, went UA, and then was classified a deserter, ultimately goes to Canada, and then ultimately dies. I mean, life is cast adrift. and ultimately his brother goes to Vietnam a second time to try to keep his younger brother out of there because there was some rule that said if there was one brother there, a second brother might not have to go. And so the
and it was called, yeah.
Yeah, and so the older brother volunteers to go back and be a company commander. Says it was, look, it wasn't all altruistic. It was good for my career, and I knew that. And the chances of me being killed as a company commander, I knew were much substantially less than they were as a rifle platoon commander. But ultimately, the younger brother who does leave the country, I mean, his life is cast adrift. Now that might have happened anyway, but ultimately dies of a drug overdose in Hong Kong, I think. And so sad stories. So, but I do, my own opinion is, I do believe that Burns is sowing an appropriate level of balance. And I don't, and even last night I mean, you forget, I don't know, Tom, and I ask you this as a historian as well. Has the nation ever been through a year as turbulent as 1968?
Here's the bell. No, I don't think it has. Back, hang on just a second, please.
Sure. Tom?
No, you're right. 1968 was such a horrible year. It was just, you know, one tragedy after another. And in my opinion, we've never had anything like that happen again or happen since. So, yeah, with the assassinations, with the turmoil, it was absolutely that case.
All right. Tom, first of all, you've been very gracious with your time today. And I wanted to do this for a while, and I know you're busy right now. So first of all, please give our best from All Marine Radio to your Marines at your reunion, and tell them that we certainly honor and respect the greatest generation that they represent. And thanks for doing this morning.
Okay, Mac, my pleasure, and God bless you and all that you're doing, and. Call them anytime that I can help.
You bet. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. God bless. Semper Fidelis.
Semper Fidelis. That is retired Marine Corps Brigadier General Tom Drouty here on a Tuesday. Interesting stuff. We're going to take a break. We're overdue. Gunner not going to join us today. He's got something going on. So we'll check news headlines, which we haven't had a chance to do. So we will do that next on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsouthfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.